delighted to welcome students from Palmyra Eagle High School, and I talked to them at noon. Would they please stand? Thank you. Won't you be seated? And we have students from Grace Christian Academy. Would they stand? And welcome to you all. Won't you be seated? Now, the court has met these guests this afternoon. There are summaries of the case that you're about to hear on that table. Aaron, would you raise your hand? Next to Aaron. And there are photos of the court as well as descriptions of the art in this room for all of those who wish to pick up a copy outside the courtroom. I'd like to, now that we've met you, introduce the court to you. On my far left is Justice Patrick Crooks. To his right is Justice Janine Geske. And to her right is Justice William Babbage. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my right is Justice Donald Steinmetz. To his right, Justice John Wilcox. And on the far right is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. We're now ready to proceed with our case for this afternoon. State of Wisconsin versus James E. And how do you pronounce his last name?
Krzyzewski.
And representing Mr. Krzyzewski is Antoinette. Is it Leitch? We are ready to proceed, Ms. Leitch. The people behind you have trouble hearing, so if you would project, that would be helpful.
I will try, Aaron. Ladies and gentlemen of the court, my name is Toni Leitch, and I represent James Krzyzewski in this matter. The issue that is before the court today is whether a trial court can impose and effectuate a penal sentence under Section 973.15 of the Wisconsin statutes, which I will refer to as the sentencing statute, on a defendant who is under a prior legal commitment under Section 971.17, which I will refer to as the NGI statute. My position is that a trial court does not have the authority to do so because of the specific language of Section 971.17, because of the policy behind the NGI statute, and further that the Wisconsin Patients' Rights Statute, which is Section 5161, is violated by allowing a court to do so. If the court is not convinced, then the court is faced with two self-contained conflicting statutes, that being Section, the NGI statute and the sentencing statute. In an attempt to harmonize statutes to allow the purposes of both statutes to be achieved, I believe that the court should expand the definition of legal cause under the sentencing statute to allow a stay of sentence for the prior NGI adjudication.
Is expanding the definition of legal cause your alternative argument or your initial argument?
I believe that the trial court does not have the authority based on the specific language of Section 971.17. I believe that that statute takes precedence. However, the expansion of legal cause would be my alternative argument.
Ms. Leitch, let me ask you if there's any difference. The legislature, as I understand it, did a major overhaul on 971.17, I think in 1991 session. And there are different rules, as I understand it, that apply if there's a commitment earlier than 1991. In other words, we've got a statute that applies to commitments after 1991 and a statute that applies to earlier commitments. Now, your client would be within the framework of an earlier commitment, is that correct?
That's correct, and that is governed by the 1987 statutes.
Do you see any problem for us in fashioning a rule, for instance, in regard to legal cause, expanding legal cause? Would that have any different effects for the two groups of people, the pre-1991 committees and those since that time?
I don't believe so, Your Honor, because the policies and the goals of the NGI statute are the same, although there has been an extensive overhaul. You're still looking at what the court was trying to do and the issues that the court deals with respect to the policy. So I believe that it would be the same for both. And the policy being the treatment of a mental illness and the treatment for dangerousness.
So you see any rule that this court might enunciate as applying to both groups without any exception?
I don't believe that the court would need to make an exception because the basis of this court's ruling, again, would be on achieving the goals of the NGI commitment statute.
Am I correct that we do not have a lot of case law in Wisconsin that defines legal cause as that's embodied in the statute?
That is correct, Your Honor. The court has made one or two definitions of legal, or the court has made one or two statements as to what is and what is not legal cause in the context of a specific issue. It does not, it has given no definition or guidance.
It's my understanding that you propose that if we buy your alternative approach, and if we go with an expansion of the idea of legal cause to cover a situation like this, that you don't think that should be done on a case-by-case basis, but rather it should be done across the board. Is that correct?
That is correct, Your Honor. And the reason for that is that you cannot let a subsequent trial court, in the context of a sentencing, make determinations with respect to removal of an individual from an NGI commitment. Why not? Because under the NGI statute, first there is a strict procedure which says that the committing court must make decisions and determinations with regard to reexamination. And there is a procedure set forth which indeed even allows for a jury trial for that purpose.
Well, they're not releasing him permanently from the mental health facility.
No, they're not.
But putting him in, you might put him in segregation in a mental health facility. It's just putting him in another institution.
That's correct. Certainly, though, a trial court's decision would have great impact on a petition for reexamination should the defendant petition for reexamination after he's been released from his penal sentence.
Can I ask you, would the issues be any different if your client was committed under Chapter 51 and was convicted of an offense and sentenced?
Would it make any difference?
Yeah, is it any different than a 971-17 proceeding? I mean,
The proceedings under the Chapter 55 are quite different than a criminal proceeding. In that under the criminal proceeding, the individual is responsible for petitioning for reexamination for release. Under a civil commitment, it expires every year and there can be a petition.
Yeah, but somebody who is in 2 months into a Chapter 51 commitment commits an aggravated battery, is convicted of aggravated battery, is not acquitted by virtue or found not guilty by virtue of mental disease or defect, receives 2 years in prison. Can that person be sentenced to prison at that point?
If the person is committed under a civil statute, I see no problem with allowing that to happen. The difference between the civil and the criminal commitment is that the individual is under the care and custody of the Department of Human Services and housed in a mental facility until he's released.
Why does that make any difference than being under an order where you are committed to a mental health facility run by the government and you're not free to leave and you're under for purposes of treatment and you're found to be dangerous and least restrictive means and all those kinds of protections that you might have? Why is that any different?
Because under a criminal commitment, you should be afforded due process rights.
There are no due process rights in a Chapter 51?
There are due process rights, but it is still a civil commitment. There's no criminal context to it.
Well, I still don't hear you tell me what the difference is. Criminal can mean double jeopardy. Can mean, why is it different whether it's criminal or civil? Aren't we talking about a statutory interpretation issue?
Yes.
Well, let's just suppose you lose. And suppose the your client then is put into a correctional institution. Okay? Can he in the correctional institution file petitions under the not guilty by reason of the NGI plea so that he could be released from the mental institution and still be in the prison?
He certainly can do that.
So all of his rights stay the same. His place of detention has changed only.
Correct.
And the correctional institution also has hospitals.
Correct.
For mentally ill.
Correct. But this the person who the defendant we're talking about has no mental illness. That's why he's in a penal institution. So the treatment that's available in the penal institution does not address his dangerousness.
Your defendant is mentally ill. That's why he's in a mental institution. He's committed an offense, and now he's in a penal institution. How did he get not mentally ill all of a sudden?
I don't know.
Well, that and nothing about this tells us other than he didn't plead that he was, ultimately he withdrew his plea of NGI, right?
In the trial court, yes.
Okay. But, so at the one and the same time, we have somebody who's mentally ill, held competent for purposes of a criminal prosecution, and now is in a correctional institution. That's what would happen.
Correct.
What's the matter with that?
The fact that the state can continue to confine the defendant after he is released from the penal institution under the NGI statute based on dangerousness denies...
That's what's bothering you? That's the underpinning for all of this?
Basically, yes, Your Honor.
But why is he dangerous? Because he committed the battery? Or because he committed... What was his original offense? Murder?
Yes.
So which is the... Why is he dangerous? Because of murder or of the battery?
Probably because of the battery.
Well, murder can be treated differently than some of the others, but there are protections of long-term detention under an NGI commitment by virtue of the statute, in that you get good time applied and you can't be held longer than the maximum sentence. I mean, there are those protections in a not guilty by mental disease, the defect commitment, whether or not somebody is also serving a jail time simultaneously. Is that right? I mean, it's not that he'll be held indefinitely under most charges.
That's true. But there still is the concept of the due process requirement of treatment of dangerousness in order to continue housing the individual under the commitment.
You would concede that there are lots of prisoners in our state prison system that are mentally ill.
Yes, I would.
And they are not in, not committed by NGI pleas, but in fact have been convicted and sentenced to the state prison system.
That's probably correct.
And does the prison system have an obligation to treat them?
The prison system has an obligation to treat them for their mental illness if the prison system is aware that they are mentally ill. Certainly.
And your client, the system obviously is aware that your client is mentally ill by virtue of the fact that he was being held under a 97117 commitment, right?
I don't believe my client is mentally ill any longer. That's why he was subsequently charged and stood trial and found guilty of the battery.
Well, why don't you file then for release?
He certainly can do that. However, the state is still obligated to be treating him for his dangerousness, quote unquote, because certainly if he files for release, he's not going to be released because he's going to be found a danger. And under the NGI statute,
he's going to be found in danger for the battery.
Correct. On that basis.
So what has that got to do where we keep him? I don't see what that has to do with whether we keep him in prison first. We send him to prison while he's under NGI, or we wait till he is authorized to be released, and then we send him to prison.
Because the state is obligated in order to continue to confine him based on dangerousness alone to offer treatment for his dangerousness, as this court held in State versus Randall, in order It is not a violation of due process to hold an individual who is no longer mentally ill under the commitment if he's being treated for dangerousness.
So you want him to be in the institution treated for dangerousness rather than in the prison?
That's correct. I believe under the statutory scheme, that's what the court has to order. In order to continue to afford him his due process rights, in order to recognize his rights as a patient under the Wisconsin Patients' Rights Act, he needs to have that treatment, and that's not going to happen in a penal setting.
Well, why does 971.17 trump 973.15 rather than the opposite?
It trumps it because the purposes of the sentencing statute can be achieved in the mental commitment, because one of the purposes for the sentencing statute is protection of the public. The public is protected if he's in a mental institute. With respect to the specific charge of battery to an inmate, which the state raised, there are various levels of security within a mental health facility. With respect to deterrence, the sentence will ultimately have to be served by the defendant. So those can be achieved in the context of the mental commitment. However, the mental commitment purposes are not going to be achieved in a penal institution.
In other words, can he be segregated from the other people in the mental institution? Yes, he certainly can. We shouldn't be concerned about safety for the other people in the institution that are there under the NGI.
If the institution feels that he's a danger, he will be put on the highest level of security and indeed could be subject to the segregation.
Well, the department thinks that if we don't do something, remove him, that's just giving a green light to all the mental patients to beat up on each other.
That's certainly what they assert. However, like I said, there are various levels of security that can be handled within the context of the mental health facility. On the other hand, there are no treatment services for dangerousness in a penal institution.
Well, counsel, I submit that having consequences and being sent to a penal institution is a form of treatment, a form of dealing with and treating and trying to change dangerous behavior is giving consequences for that behavior. One of the things that concerns me in this case is you're saying your client isn't mentally ill, but he is dangerous, as perhaps are many of the inmates in our prisons. That's why they're there. But by keeping him in a mental institution, although not mentally ill, but dangerous, he can engage in further criminal activity with impunity, arguably. That is, with no criminal consequences for his criminal behavior. Respond to that concern of deterrence and consequences.
The consequences would occur after he is released from the commitment. He is still going to have to serve a sentence. My position is not that the state cannot prosecute him for it.
Well, that's assuming he would at some point found not to be dangerous. If he kept committing dangerous acts and violent acts, not punished for them, he probably will never get released because he'll continue to be considered dangerous, but yet there are no consequences.
But the consequences, by virtue of the way that the statutes are set up here in Wisconsin, the consequences need to be resolved within the context of the mental institution.
Is there anything in the record that says that he's not mentally ill?
There
a finding by a trial court?
Okay. There was no finding. There was. He did plead NGI, and that plea was withdrawn.
That could be for lots of reasons.
Certainly.
Ms. Leach, I should probably know the answer to this question, but I don't, so I ask it. How can your client, stay in under that NGI statute in perpetuity? Forever, regardless of the length of sentence regardless of the penalty that the statute imposed?
I believe it's a two-thirds of the maximum sentence is.
So at some point or other, then, this deterrence doesn't work.
Correct.
Because he knows he's going to have to get out.
Ultimately.
And if, in fact, he's got 2 weeks to go, before he knows he has to be released regardless, you're handing him a get-out-of-jail card then, aren't you?
Correct.
I'm not trying to put words in your mouth.
The deterrence is there. He's going to have to serve the time.
What is his underlying conviction? Is it a first-degree murder? Or
his underlying conviction, yes, is first-degree
murder. So does he have an MR date?
I'm not certain whether he has an MR date or not.
Because unlike, obviously, there's no maximum sentence other than life, and I think the statute provides for it, but I don't know what it was. You don't know what his MR date is?
No, I don't.
But at his MR date, your position would be then he goes to the correctional institution.
Correct.
If there is an MR date.
Correct.
If not, he stays in the mental institution.
He should stay in the mental institution. With respect to Justice Babbage's question as to why the goals of sentence or why the goals of NGI are not going to be achieved in a sentencing, the most important factor to me is that there are no checks and balances in the Department of Corrections to ensure that he is being treated in accordance with his rights under his mental commitment. Department of Corrections is free to transfer him wherever they want to once he's under their authority, state to state, within the state, and quite frankly, into a federal penitentiary if they choose. My last correspondence from Mr. Krzyzewski was from Marion, Illinois, the federal penitentiary. They certainly are not doing anything to treat his dangerousness under the Wisconsin commitment. They're not ensuring that he's being treated appropriately under Wisconsin's commitment statute. And by allowing the trial court to make a determination of removing him from his mental commitment, putting him into a prison sentence where he's now in a federal penitentiary in Illinois, is basically invading on the specific procedure set forth in 971 with respect to reexaminations. He's already made that determination. So when the defendant is released from the penitentiary, should he choose to petition for reexamination, the decision has already been made. He's already been removed. And he has not been receiving the treatment he was afforded under the Wisconsin Patient Rights Statute and under the mental commitment.
So you think he'll be confined longer in the
yes.
mental institution?
Yes. Oh, I'm sure they're not going to be releasing him until they have to. They're getting their cake and they're eating it too. They're imposing a penal sentence and they're keeping him under his commitment.
Is there anything stopping your client from petitioning for a review at this point under 971-17, even though he's serving the sentence?
There is nothing stopping him, and quite frankly, I have advised him to do so, because if the state comes back and says, we want to hold you because you're dangerous, then he will have the argument that he's not being treated for his dangerousness, and therefore keeping him under the commitment is a violation of his due process rights under State versus Randall.
Has he actually in the past petitioned for reexamination?
Mr. Krzyzewski has not.
So there's never been a jury trial on the issue of dangerousness, other than perhaps at the front end when he was first found not guilty by reason of mental disease?
Correct.
And he was convicted when? 1975.
Correct.
Counsel, are there any other questions? You have a few minutes left if you'd like to use them.
Well, I think, again, the court has to consider when the state can continue to confine Mr. Krzyzewski, despite the fact that he is no longer mentally ill, with respect to how they can continue to confine him. The justification would be a treatment for dangerousness when you remove him from the institute and you put him into a penal setting. You're not treating him for dangerousness.
Counsel, I know that at least a statutory you're tied to the Wisconsin statutes, but on due process, what do other states do, and what does the federal system do?
The other states have, there are only two reported cases, which I believe were cited in both the state and my brief. They use their inherent common law authority to stay the sentence, awaiting the expiration of the mental commitment.
In the federal system?
No case law.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. You have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Mr. Weinstein, Assistant Attorney General representing the state of Wisconsin.
My name is Warren Weinstein, and I'm Assistant Attorney General representing the state of Wisconsin in this case. I guess where my analysis differs somewhat with the petitioner's analysis in this case is that as soon as I look at the language of these two statutes, I immediately see a conflict. Apparently the Court of Appeals didn't, but we have two self-contained statutes, both of which say that you can only be released under the procedure in that section, and neither of the sections makes allowance for the other. And it seems to me that as soon as you have that conflict, then it's incumbent upon the court to try to harmonize the statutes to accomplish the purposes of both, if possible. And if not, then one has to choose, I suppose, between one or the other. And in my view, the Court of Appeals did give preference to the correct statute. And I believe that's because the NGI statute's purpose of treatment can be accomplished either in the prison system, which does maintain some ability to treat mental illness within the system. And if they can't treat it there, there are provisions for transferring the person onto the forensic units in Mendota and Winnebago under DHFS. Now, that procedure doesn't appear in the record, but it's my understanding that what happens is there's an actual 5121 petition filed.
Now, in this case, I noticed he's in Marion, Illinois. Is that because there's a, quote, forensic unit there, or just because there wasn't any room? Why is he down there?
I don't know why he's down there, but I do know that there was an outstanding detainer against him while he was over at Mendota. And whether or not that has something to do with the fact that he ultimately ended up in Marion or not, I don't know. I think that is the reason. I'm reading it. This isn't in the record. I'm inferring this, but I think that the reason he did not petition for either a conditional release or for a reexamination under 97117 himself was because he had this outstanding detainer, and he preferred to stay at Mendota rather than wherever he would end up. Where he convicted.
Is Marion in Illinois considered a prison for the very, very naughty?
That's my understanding. Yes.
Mr. Weinstein, you've talked about the court taking the approach initially of trying to harmonize the two statutes. And it's my understanding that your suggestion is that we use legal cause from 973.158A in order to do that. It's also my understanding that you've suggested that we have the trial courts look at whether or not there is legal cause on a case-by-case basis. My question is, what test would the trial courts use in making that determination?
Well, I think they would have to balance both the purposes for the NGI commitment, whether it's the person's already under an NGI commitment or it's conceivable that somebody who is in the institution will be found NGI after committing an offense in the institution. But in either event, I think you'd have to look what purposes this particular defendant's situation, can it be met in the prison? How is putting the person in a mental institution as opposed to the prison system going to affect whatever population he's currently in, which was Judge Frankel's overriding concern in this case based on Van Rybrook's testimony, because they were concerned about the effect that leaving Mr. Krzyzewski at Mendota would have on both the patient population in general and his interaction with the patients there. It is true that Mendota does have some other options in terms of security, but he was already on a forensic unit, so it wasn't like there was no security at all.
Would the court be looking at treatment situations? In other words, would the court be looking not only at dangerousness and not only at how the population in each institution might be served by placing him at the other institution, but also would be looking at whether or not he was in need of treatment, and if so, where that treatment could be best provided?
I think so, yes. And if the treatment could not be provided in the prison system, then it would seem to me to be best to have the NGI commitment either continue or go into effect, whichever situation you have. And if the treatment could be accomplished in the prison system, then depending on the other factors, one might leave him in the prison system. For instance, if all that would happen would be that this particular person would have to be administered psychotropic drugs, then that certainly could be accomplished in the prison system without too much difficulty.
Let me ask you just a procedural question. What is your position on if a court can sentence a defendant to prison, such as in this case, and there is an outstanding commitment under 97117, is the defendant receiving post-trial prison credit on the outstanding commitment for the time that he'd be in the institution?
Actually, I think the Court of Appeals dealt with that in the Haar case and indicated that if he was actually held under the commitment, then that does not qualify under the statute for time for credit.
One of the reasons I ask is by virtue of what the Court of Appeals here taught, they struck the provision that is concurrent with 97117, which might give rise to that argument that they're both. And so the question is whether it's almost a stay of that mental commitment.
Well, there was no formal stay of the mental commitment order. In the absence of a stay, either of the commitment, NGI commitment, or the sentence, it seems to me that
they really
regardless
are.
Who has custody, they're both going to be running. So I guess I disagree somewhat with the petitioner's position on that, too, because unless the court has the authority to stay the sentence, it seems to me it has to run, and there may or may not be anything left at the time of the discharge.
The sentence would really be running under the petitioner's position. The sentence would really be running concurrently with the commitment.
Yeah, although we can't use that term. Yeah.
I understand. I know, but in effect.
Yeah, without a stay, I think the only way to delay the running of the time for the sentence is to stay it.
Now, the Court of Appeals has a very easy, bright line rule, if I understand. That if you're in a mental institution, you're convicted of a crime, you go to prison instantly.
That's right.
And then when you finish your prison term, you go back to the mental institution.
Unless you would be discharged.
Unless you're discharged under the ordinary system.
Yeah.
Now, the defendant has also a very simple bright line rule. That is, you stay in the mental institution.
Right.
And I understood it to say, although maybe not, that when you finish the mental institution, then you go to prison. Now, you indicate maybe not, and I'll ask that when she rises again. But you don't really argue for the simple bright-line rule that the Court of Appeals takes, right?
That's right. I don't. That's the disadvantage, I guess, of my position.
Right. You have your position. So what you're arguing is a fuzzy line, as I see it. That is trial court discretion, right?
Yeah, if one can even call that a line, yes.
Right. Well, that's what I'm leading up to. And I think in your brief, you do indicate what the basis for the exercise of that discretion is, don't you? As best you could.
Yeah.
Which I can't find at the moment, but maybe you can tell me. As I understood it, it's whether or not the person was more in need of mental health care than the need of punishment in prison. And it would, and the severity of the offense, etc., the effect on the other patients. That's the kind of criteria you're thinking about.
Yes, that's correct.
Reviewable for erroneous exercise of discretion.
Yes, just like sentencing.
Why do you want to impose that kind of burden on the courts?
Because I think it gets to the right result. And I think that that's somewhat illustrated by the Haar case, where there was under the Court of Appeals bright line rule, there was a person who had been convicted of or had been found NGI in an unrelated case while some charges were pending, and then pled no contest. Under the Court of Appeals ruling, that person went to DOC. No discretion of any kind on the circuit court. Yet, that seems to me to be an ideal case where the person hadn't had any time at all, or very little, in DHFS at the time of the sentence. And the judge obviously thought that because he tried to make the sentence consecutive, thought that Mr. Haar could benefit from that. And it seems to me that we ought to give the trial courts that discretion. As with sentencing, they're really in the best position to be able to call those kinds of close, they probably are close calls, but still, I mean, we let them do it with probation, we let them do it with sentencing, and it seems at some point we have to trust the trial judges to be able to make those kinds of determinations.
But doesn't it work better? This is a follow-up to the Chief's question. Doesn't it work better to send this defendant back to the institution where he will be, at least theoretically, constantly evaluated for the mental disease or defect, and then when they determine that he is no longer suffering from that, to start serving his sentences? Now you've got professionals at the hospital making this judgment.
Well, I think there are two problems with that. One is the one that Dr. Van Rybrook expressed in his testimony, which is the effect that, in essence, what the patients see as no consequence to the criminal activity has on the overall population. And the second problem with that, it seems to me, is that if you're going to want to have the sentence there after the discharge or conditional release under the NGI, it seems to me you still have to have the authority to stay the sentence, which we don't currently have, because this situation hasn't come up, and the couple or three situations that have been dealt with so far under legal cause aren't sufficient to say, with any certainty at least, that this constitutes legal cause. So even if you want to accomplish that, and even if you believe that the appropriate thing in the first instance is always the NGI commitment, it seems to me you still need the stay authority. I would differ on whether or not in all instances the NGI should take precedence in the first instance. It may be that in most do, and it may be that this is a pretty rare situation, because most of the people who are NGI probably would be found NGI on the second offense. But in this particular case, it didn't happen. In Mr. Haar's particular fact situation, because of the timing of the NGI and the convictions, it also didn't happen. So it does come up sometimes.
Now, is it a violation of the rules of the mental institution to hit? I assume it is.
Oh, yeah.
And so many of these offenses of battery are handled as a discipline matter within the institution, just like they are in prison. I mean, many of them are handled that way. It's only when it gets beyond whatever the supervision is, the things that's beyond the pale, that you move into circuit court.
Yes, I think that's true. I mean, I think one of the reasons that the criminal procedure was pursued in this particular case was that the treating physicians at Mendota probably didn't believe Mr. Krzyzewski was no longer incompetent, and I think with most people who they believe are incompetent, they would just treat it under the disciplinary proceedings. Yeah, and I think there's probably a reluctance on the part of prosecutors to bring some of these cases for that very reason. They're afraid that they'll just go off on an NGI, and it's a lot of paperwork and problems for nothing.
I don't know anything about the disciplinary proceedings in mental hospitals, but I suspect it's a very different kind of format than in the prison setting, in as much as they're there for treatment purposes and not for punishment purposes. I mean, I don't know.
That's right. I think it probably amounts to segregation and perhaps restraint, depending on the particular.
But I assume
offense.
The medical concerns of the patient have to remain the overriding determining factor as opposed to punishment.
Yeah, and I think there have been and probably will in the future be some litigation over how much you can do in a mental institution. Because if it, even once the person has demonstrated some dangerous behavior, you can't just punish the person without the criminal conviction. What you have to tailor whatever it is, if it's segregation, which is basically locking them up in a room, I think, you have to tailor that to the type of dangerousness and the length of danger. So if someone is only dangerous for a couple of hours, then if you extend it beyond that period, you're going to get yourself into some trouble under 5161.
As a practical matter, how often are the trial courts confronted with this kind of situation, Mr. Weinstein?
Well, I wouldn't have thought it was very very often until I got two of them, right?
Oh, really?
I have to think that it is fairly rare, but I really don't know for sure.
Mr. Weinstein, your opposing counsel has indicated that if we adopted your approach, the case-by-case approach, that would violate 97117. Do you see that conflict? Do you see that violation?
No, I really don't. It seems to me that once you've got a conviction, that the trial court has the authority pursuant to that conviction to make a determination about where the person should end up. If the Court of Appeals is correct and 973.15 takes precedence over 97117, then it doesn't seem to me that there's any greater deprivation by allowing the judge to select than there is in an automatic letting the sentence go into effect under 973.15. It's the same deprivation in both cases. So it seems to me, if anything, that giving the court discretion can ameliorate some, in particular cases, some harsh operation of the statute, which might very well be to the committee's benefit.
What about the due process argument?
I didn't make one.
Oh, I know you didn't. How do you answer it?
You can deprive persons of liberty and after due process, and it seems to me that the criminal adjudication is the process that's due.
Even though you're violating what the statute says about giving him commitment to mental health institution. I mean, that was the process that was due him. He was found incompetent, therefore he was found not guilty, therefore he's entitled to be in a mental institution and released under the statutes. Now he's in the mental institution. He's not released in accordance with the statutes. He is released under a different statute. Therefore, he's not getting due process under his first commitment. I mean,
under the current published case, the Court of Appeals case,
right,
it seems to me Mr. Krzyzewski got his due process when the legislature decided that this 973.15 would go into effect regardless of the existence of 971.17. And certainly the legislature can do that. There wouldn't be a due process claim if 971.17 said that if person is discharged under this section if they are convicted and sentenced under 973.15. And likewise, there would be no problem under 973.15 if the legislature said if there is an NGI commitment, the court shall enter a sentence which shall take effect later or whatever it decided to do with it.
Now, just let me understand, because the Court of Appeals said this is just plain on its face, and that's what the legislature meant. So, and I know normally your position would be to defend that aspect of the case, but I notice you're just running away from that. You're not... You feel that that's indefensible, and it's not? Isn't that a legislative intent? That's what the legislature meant? That's what the statute says? It's plain on its face?
Well, that's certainly the way the Court of Appeals reads it, but when I look at those two, I don't see how you can reach that point, because both of them are self-contained, and neither one refers to the other.
You have two plain statutes, the way you read it.
Right.
You
well,
plain statutes if, on their face.
That's right. If you look at each one individually, they're plain on their face. It's when you put them together that you have the problem.
You can't satisfy both statutes in this.
That's right. At least that's the way I read them.
Right. You've got to either satisfy one or the other.
And
that
in fact,
makes the conflict.
Yes. And in fact, the Court of Appeals decision does give preference to one over
right.
the other, even though they say it's...
And they say that's the public policy that was established by legislative...
Yeah, and I have no quarrel with that. I believe that's correct.
And that's what we're just saying. That's what I'm picking
yes,
up.
Yes. I reached the same result for the same reasons as the Court of Appeals. The only difference I have with them is that I have to concede a conflict to get there, and they didn't.
Well, you have the same result in this case, but in
right.
the next case, the result may be very different under your theory
well,
versus
if you don't
the
give,
Court of Appeals theory.
If you don't give the circuit courts the authority to stay, then I think that the result that's required is, in every case, DOC takes precedence and the sentence
that's
goes
That's right.
Into
so
effect.
In another case, the result may be very different depending upon you. Whether your interpretation is picked up or the Court of Appeals is picked up.
That's right. Without the ability to stay, I think the Court of Appeals result is the correct one.
Go ahead.
We're more interested than the person who just dropped.
Yeah, I figured that. I was hoping that.
I have a question. You don't have to respond to this one. You represent the state of Wisconsin. Do you represent the Department of Corrections or the department that runs the mental institution?
DHFS.
Or both? Or neither? I mean, is this...
In this particular case,
yeah.
Neither.
That's what I thought. You represent neither. So who do you represent, and how do you reach a decision as to what position to take? And as I say...
That was the second question's easier answer than the first one.
Well, and I'm asking this because I've heard discussions with department heads that sometimes the Attorney General's office, and I'm not trying to be critical, I'm trying to get a sense here. Doesn't ask them what they want.
Well, we many times ask them, but we a lot of times
don't do
what they want anyway.
I accept that correction. So that's why I'm saying, now, does the Department of Corrections want these guys immediately? Do the mental health people want them out immediately?
DHFS does want him out immediately. I'm not sure whether DOC wants him or not.
Right.
I'm not sure they view themselves as having much of a choice.
Uh-huh.
The way we do this is that when I get the case, I make an initial assessment about what I think the statutes require and talk to my supervisor, and sometimes we talk to various other people, and eventually through our administrative hierarchy, we decide what position to go with, which may or may not be the same position as DHFS or DOC, who I would think, if they were that interested, could intervene in the case and present their own view. Certainly I would not oppose any such
mm-hmm.
move on their part. They have different interests. We're primarily concerned with the criminal prosecution, and we try very hard to do what the DAs want, but we don't necessarily do what the other state agencies want.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Weinstein.
Leitch.
If you would just clarify, at the end, if your client went to prison immediately, at the end of the prison stay, would the client return to the mental institution and would the time have ticked off so that it would be credited?
There's no answer for that.
What's your answer?
I would assume that the time would have to be credited to his stay at the mental health institute.
If that's the case, what about the reverse, that if your client goes to the mental health facility, isn't he concurrently, whether you use that term or not, concurrently serving his sentence, and so he would never serve his sentence?
I don't believe so. If the sentence is not imposed, or if the sentence is stayed, then he would serve the sentence after he is released from the mental health institution. And I wanted to address the question that you asked me with respect to civil commitment versus criminal commitment. In a civil commitment, if you're no longer mentally ill, there is no reason to hold you. However, in the criminal commitment, your mental illness can be gone and they can still hold you based on the dangerousness aspect.
But we don't know whether he's mentally ill or not here. I mean, that is one of the possibilities.
That certainly is one of the possibilities. In Mr. Krzyzewski's case, I believe the mental health facility says he is not mentally ill.
That's part of the record?
I believe it was in the sentencing transcript.
One of my concerns, and I haven't read the sentencing transcript, of your comments earlier was your assertion that he was not mentally ill any longer. But I didn't know how that could be relevant to our consideration if no one has filed a petition. Unless it's in the record, unless someone has made a finding of that. It seems to me that for our analysis, your assertion that he's no longer mentally ill might be irrelevant. Tell me why it's not irrelevant. Tell me what in the records.
It's not irrelevant because if he's no longer mentally ill, he's not going to be prosecuted and or found guilty of a subsequent crime.
Where in the record does it say that he is no longer mentally ill? Is it?
I believe it's in the sentencing transcript, and I believe it's Mr. Van Rybrook who makes the statement that he is no longer mentally ill. I could be wrong, but that's my recollection.
I mean, has a court found that he's no longer mentally ill? Has a petition been filed to release him or discharge him either by the defendant or by the state?
Not that I'm aware of.
Counsel, if there are no further questions, you may conclude if you
okay,
wish.
Okay, just to
you
respond.
Until the red light
comes okay,
on.
Just to respond to the fact that the appellate court's bright line approach in terms of automatically sentencing the defendant to a prison sentence and the state's position that a trial court should make the determination, I believe both those approaches do not give full force and effect to the NGI statute itself. Again, the specific language states who the custodian is, where the individual should be housed, and the procedure by which he should be removed from the Department of Human Services and the mental health institution. To allow a trial court to make that determination takes away the procedure in terms of a jury trial on the issue, and it enables the trial court to make a decision which has consequences in the NGI reexamination procedure.
Let me ask you a question. What if a defendant had been conditionally released under 97117? He's in the community. There's a court order that he shall receive treatment on a regular basis. All these conditions, he's out. He commits a new crime. Doesn't your argument hold that he could not be sentenced on a new charge because he's under the commitment under 971 and he's not receiving the benefits of that commitment if he's sent to the state prison system?
He would be receiving the benefits in terms of being out on the conditional discharge.
Not when he's sent to prison. Not when he commits
Correct.
A new crime.
Correct.
My question is, you have a defendant who's out under 97117, supposed to be getting treatment by the department, supervision, release, all part of his treatment mode, same as being in or out, but he's out, commits a new crime, and the judge wants to sentence him to prison for the new crime.
Correct.
Can he be sent to prison?
I don't believe so, not if he is still under his commitment.
So you have to leave him in the community. Your position is, unless they revoke the conditional commitment, which obviously they could, but unless they revoke that conditional commitment, despite the fact that there may be a new felony charge and conviction, he'd have to be left in the community.
Under the way the statute's read today, yes.
Any other questions?
Counsel?
Thank you. We are adjourned until the December sitting.